welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, bringing you broadcasts from radio's yesteryear. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, and there's science fiction stories coming up in this hour from two programs not necessarily known for their sci-fi stories. Later on, it's The Mysterious Traveler from 1949, but first, radio's outstanding theater of thrills, suspense, the CBS broadcast called Stranger with My Face from July 23rd, 1961.
And now, a tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
A tale of two men who are one. Stranger with My Face, starring Bernard Grant, and written especially for Suspense by Alan Sloan.
So you're walking along the street, minding your own business, except for an occasional glance at an occasional pretty girl. But it isn't the occasion, never has been, never will be, so what's the use? Sufficient unto the day is the boredom thereof, and why, oh, why doesn't something happen? So you might as well stop at the newsstand and pick up the papers, grab the usual quick one at the usual bar.
Look out, mister! Look out, hey! Anybody get the taxi's license?
Oh.
Hey, give him air. Come on, give him room. He's coming too. Easy. Yeah. Easy, Mr. Hill. Let me help you to the curb. Gee, talk about your close calls, mister.
Hey, what happened? Where am I? Where's my hat?
Now, what happened? You was reaching for the papers I was handing you. The mob shoved you in a taxi, sideswiped you. If I was you, I'd go straight to the doctor and see if everything's still in the right place.
But this isn't my hat.
Well, believe me, mister, it's the one that come with the head you're still wearing.
Fine way to start the day.
Yeah, ain't it, though? It's a real close... Start the day? Mister, you sure you're all right? Those are the evening papers. And you owe me 14 cents.
14? Since when?
Times and Trib, 7 apiece, like any evening paper.
The Times and Tribune are morning papers.
Not in Chicago, mister.
So there you are in a strange city, with a lot of strangers minding your business. And a strange sound of the police whistles. And a strange big star in the cops' uniforms. And strange names on the buses, Boulevard, Halsted, State. No. What you need is something familiar to cling to, like a shot glass of bourbon. So up the street you find a tavern. You sit down at its totally strange bar. And a totally strange bartender greets you with...
Evening, sir. Your usual?
My usual? What's that?
Always a kitty. Scotch on the rocks, soda on the side.
Your impulse is to say, I hate scotch. But you don't say it. Something, now that you've discovered where you are, Chicago, something makes you want to know when you are. The newspapers will tell you. July 13th, 1961.
Yes, sir, all day.
Scotch or no scotch, you make it do. Despite the warmth of the stuff clawing its way down, the taste it leaves is like old iron in your mouth. You lift the glass of soda. The bartender moves away. And a stranger in the mirror drops his glass.
Oh, I'll clean that up, Mr. Morris.
Bartender.
Yes, sir.
Now, look, don't think I'm drunk, do you know me?
Do I know you? What do you mean, do I know you?
Do you know who I am? My name.
Why, sure, Mr. Morris. You're Mr. Morris, one of my regulars.
Mr. Morris, one of your regulars. Well, tell me, what's my first name?
Why, I've heard your friends, sir. I've heard them call you... Mr. Morris, you're joking.
No. My first name, please.
Why, they call you Chuck. I guess it must be Charles. Look, Mr. Morris, if you're not feeling well...
Wait. When I sat down, you asked me if I wanted the usual. And you served me...
Scotch, like always.
How long is always?
Why, let's see. It must be 2-3 years. You've been coming in nearly every day around this time, and it's always scotch on the rocks, soda on the side.
2-3 years. And this is Chicago?
Yes, sir.
July 13th, 1961?
Yes, sir, all day.
Yeah, very funny. Would you like to hear something really funny? Very, very funny?
Why, sure, Mr. Morris. Anything for a laugh.
Then laugh at this! As far as I know, this isn't Chicago, it's New York.
It isn't July 1961. It's March 1957.
Now, listen,
and it's
Mr.
morning.
Morris,
it's
please.
Not evening. But funniest of all, my name isn't Morris. And it isn't Chuck for Charles. It's Walters. Edward, Eddie, Ed Walters. And this will kill you. You will die laughing. That isn't me in the mirror. I never saw that face before in my life.
Up the street is a cheap hotel where they don't care what name you register under. But the face in the mirror upstairs is still a stranger's, with its gray hair, heavy-rimmed eyeglasses, and mustache. Impossible. Who am I? An hour later, you're on a jet from New York. And as it arches across the miles of Manhattan, things begin to come back. Except that there's something missing. Somewhere, something you almost don't want to remember, try as you may. Let's see. Let's take it from the top. Now, that morning, you left your apartment.
Morning, Mr. Walters. Nice day if it don't rain, huh?
Morning, Frank.
Going on a little trip, huh, sir?
How'd you know?
I seen a bag, sir, that's all.
Oh. Well, look, Frank.
Yes, sir?
If anybody calls this morning, don't let them disturb Mrs. Wallace. She isn't feeling so well.
Right.
Know? And if anybody asks about me, well, frankly, I'm sneaking off to Florida to play golf and fish, you know.
Sure.
But if anybody asks, I'm out of town on a business trip. You don't know where I am or when I'm coming back, right?
Sure thing. Hey, gee, thanks, Mr. Wallace. With that kind of dough, I've never even seen you in my life.
So far, all clear. Cab to Grand Central Station, all clear. Train to Chicago, heading ultimately for... Heading for... Los Angeles? Portland? Vegas? No, that you can't recall. Or for the life of you, why you left. After 7 years. 7 years with the wrong woman. And her men. And her bottles. And her yakety-yakety-yakety-yak. But still, you can't really remember much beyond arriving in Chicago and walking down a dark street. Wait. It's all coming back now.
Mister.
Yes?
You got a cigarette?
Well, sure. Here, help yourself.
Thanks. Match?
Oh, yes. Wait a minute. Here's my lighter.
Thanks a million.
Yes.
Nice lighter.
Yes.
Expensive.
Look, if you don't mind...
I'll take the satchels, too.
Boy, this is an outrage.
Nah, just a stick-up. Don't make waves. Put them up and keep them up.
How in the night over that night in Chicago it comes back, his hard, expert hands going over you. Finding your wallet, finding your watch, taking every last penny, taking your train tickets, cleaning you out, holding the gun on you while he stopped for your bags, and then...
I don't like you, mister. Turn around.
Oh, please, I'm a stranger here in town. I don't know a soul here. Please.
Shut up. Oh.
That must have been when it began. A slugging in the dark. And an awakening to find you'd nothing to remember yourself by. When a stranger found you in his parking lot come morning.
Are you all right?
I think so. Oh, no. Oh, my head.
Well, let's have a look. Oh. Hey, you're lucky you're alive, man. You've been mugged pretty good. Look, I tell you what. My office is next door. Suppose you come in and get clean.
No. I was going someplace. But I can't remember. All right. If it isn't too much trouble...
Oh, nonsense. You do the same for me. You'll feel better with some coffee and a shave. Come on your feet, fella. Oh, by the way, my name is Shaw, Clifford Shaw. I'm in real estate.
Well, my name is Morris. Charles Morris.
Oh, I get it. Morris for that building across the street. Charles for the station. Well, it doesn't matter, fella, how still stake you to a breakfast.
No, no, no. You don't understand. I don't know my name. I don't know where I am. Or who I am. Or anything. I just don't remember anything.
And that, as the jet winds into its glide path for Idlewild, is all you can piece together about how you became Chuck for Charles Morris, how he made a new life, who helped, what he did, all gone. And as useless to you now as yesterday's newspaper. What you want is to find out the state of the life of the man you really are, Ed Walters. The state of the life and the state of the wife of. Home. Where the times and the trips start the day. Or morning papers. Should you
phone first?
No, no. She's probably still climbing the walls over this morning's argument. No, not this morning. 4 years ago. Better just walk in on her.
Surprise, Helen. Surprise.
Taxi! Same lobby, new elevators, automated. Buttons to press. You press 14. 3. What did you read once about amnesia? 5. Nature's healing way of helping the mind forget. 7. Forget something the mind recoils from remembering. 9. A knock on the head is only the trigger to forgetting. 11. What did you want to forget? 14. Play it cool. Just the truth. You've been sick. You've been away. But you're better now. Bygones and all that. Brand new start, Helen. And when she opens the door, smile. Smile. She used to like your smile. Now. 14C. Ah, why didn't you think of flowers, stupid?
Yes?
I'm sorry. I was expecting someone else.
Maybe you've got the wrong apartment. This is 14.
No, 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 no. It's all right. Some friends of mine used to live here. I've been away. Well, I realize it sounds silly, but instead of phoning first, I wanted to surprise them. I'm sorry. To have embarrassed you.
We all do silly things. Maybe I can help you.
Well, I don't see how.
Well, the superintendent readdresses the mail when people move. Maybe they left a forwarding address. I'll call her.
She leaves the door open. You can see the familiar hall, the jog that leads into the living room. And suddenly you want to get away. Why, you don't know. You can't remember. You don't want to remember. But it's too late.
Well, I think I can help you.
Well, you're really very kind. I hate to trouble you.
Oh, heavens, no trouble. The way people move around in this town, it's a wonder anybody finds anybody. And tear things down. Why, only last week...
address, please.
I'm sorry. It's 695 East 53rd
Street. East 53rd.
695. Mr. and Mrs. Porter. Was that the name?
Porter. Yes. Thank you so much. Thanks for nothing. Porter. Walters, Mrs. Edward J. No. Wait a minute. She could have moved out after you left. Sure. Why keep up that big place by herself? Yes, she moved. And the Porters took the apartment. Dead end. What now? Downtown to the office to pick up right where you left off? What for? The same old grind. Cook up the deals, swing the deals, foul up the deals, and worse. Walk around wondering when you're going to run into her with another man the way... Wait a minute. Porter. No. Must be a new one. And maybe she married him. Why, sure. Sure, that's it. She's married again. Grab your hat, Mrs. Porter. Here comes Charlie. No. Ed. I'm getting mixed up again. 695 East. Ooh, coming up in the world, by golly. Remodeled brownstone and all that. $75,000 worth of decorating on a $25,000 frame. I wonder what he does, this Porter. Well, you'll find out.
Yes?
Mrs. Porter?
Yes?
I wonder if you can help me. I was given your name and address by the superintendent of the apartment house you used to live in.
Just a moment. May I ask who you are? Do you have any identification?
Huh? Oh, yes, of course. Forgive me. Here's my card.
Charles Morris, real estate. Chicago? What's this all about?
It's a legal matter, Miss Porter. You see, my firm represents an estate in Chicago. Very complicated holding, Chicago, Washington, New York.
I see.
Well, to make a long story short, we can't seem to locate the Walters, Mrs. Walters, to be specific, who lived in your apartment, 14C, before you.
I still don't understand.
You see, Mrs. Walters is one of the people whose signature my firm needs to clear up the estate, New York-wise.
Oh. Well, how can I help you?
Anything you might tell me about them. Do you know by any chance where they went after they moved out of 14C?
Of course not. All we were given to understand by the real estate agent was some kind of trouble between them.
Oh, trouble? Well, would you know...
No, just trouble. If you really want to find out, I should think you'd go to the police.
Well, I don't know. I'd hate to do that.
Yes, I'll bet you would. The nerve of you coming here like this. I think I know what the trouble was between the Walters. Men like you ought to be put away.
Dead end. One avenue left open. Friends, the Betts, the Markers, the Farrens. They might know, they might help. But then again, they might not. Who would know? Who would know? Who would help? Something happened back there in 57, back there in 14C. Who would know?
I should think you'd go to the police.
Maybe she had something there. The real estate story is your best card.
Yes, sir.
Missing persons?
Like on the door. Can I help you, sir?
Well, I hope so. You see, it's rather complicated.
Aren't they all? Sit down, sit down.
My name is Charles Morris. I'm from Chicago. Here's my card.
Real estate. Yes, sir?
My firm is involved in an estate problem, but some of the titles of the individual parcels aren't clear. Now, there's a Mrs. Edward Walters.
Walters, right.
Middle initial J. Listed as one of the title holders of a problem parcel. We just can't seem to find it. No, I've checked the former addresses, friends. Can't locate her. Just dropped out of sight.
It happens every day.
So I thought it might simplify matters before engaging a private investigator if I came to you.
All right, let's throw a check into it. Sam.
Yeah?
Another cop at a typewriter swings around.
Sam, give me a search on Walters, Mrs. Edward J.
Yeah.
What's her first name?
Oh, that would be Helen.
Try Mrs. Edward J., then try Helen. Mm-hmm. You take the wanteds, I'll take the missing.
Well, what's that, Sergeant?
Oh, sometimes a missing person is wanted for some crime somewhere, so we file them both in here.
Oh, I see. But I doubt...
Well, you never can tell. Never hurts to make sure. Only take a minute to double-check. Vikowski, Wald, Wallace, Walsh, Walton, Walter... Walter?
Walters, with an S.
Walters. Nope. Nobody here by that name, Mr.
Morris.
Yeah. Nothing under Walters with an S, sorry. Let me see what Sam's got under the wand.
Oh, that's all right, Sergeant. I suppose I'll just have to advertise...
Hold your horses. We might have something here.
Well, I'm a little pressed for time.
I said, hold on a minute, mister.
Well, all right. You sit there with two New York cops minding your business, and you want to run. The way the sergeant said, hold on a minute, that was no request, that was a command. What a fool thing to do. What a fool place to come to. What if Helen had done something wrong and you had to pay for it now? They're looking at you. The sergeant and the other cop. The younger cop's coming toward you. Passing you. Going to the door. He's stopping. You want to turn, but...
Mr. Morris.
Yes?
We find a card here.
Yes?
Walters is the name.
With an S?
With an S, yeah.
Mrs. Edward Walters?
No, sir. Mister.
Oh, well, that's a step in the right direction. I'll look him up.
You don't understand, Mr. Morris. This is a wanted. Let me read it to you.
Well, I don't think that's necessary. You see, we're not interested in Mr. Walters at all.
We are. It says here, Walters, Edward J., age 38. How old are you, Mr. Morris?
35.
Height 5'11", hair black, weight. Well, I don't have to go through the whole thing. There's a picture. No mustache, no glasses, no crew cut. But even so... Now, it says something else on the card. You don't know what it says on the card? One word. One word, Mr. Walters.
All right. I'm Walters. But I've had amnesia. I really was Charles Morris for 4 years. I just wanted to find my wife. I can't remember anything. What does it say on the card?
You had amnesia? That's a weird story.
How can you make him believe you? Or Sam, the other cop, standing with his back to the door. You turn, and you are looking straight into a police positive 38. And it is looking straight at you, and it is not wobbling. But everything else is getting wobbly. It's hazy, strange, forgettish. Your head, what's happening?
You'll never find your wife, Mr. Walters. It says here you're wanted for murder. Hers. Now come along quiet, Mr. Walters. That's best. Now, Sam, mind the store.
Now I know.
What do you know?
Well, I was trying to forget. I killed her.
Yeah. That's what it says here.
Where?
On the card. Dad, you better not talk. Anything you say, Mr. Walters.
Walters?
Come on. Let's go down the hall.
You called me Walters.
Walters. Morris. Have it your way.
But who is Walters? My name is Morris.
Sure it is. Put the collar on him, Sam. Let the head shrinkers figure this one out.
Look! My card! I'm Chuck Morris, Chicago. Where? How did I get here? What city is this? What do you want with me? Why do you call me Walters? What do you want with me? My name is Morris. 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 Morris.
Suspense. You've been listening to Stranger with My Face, starring Bernard Grant and written especially for Suspense by Alan Sloan.
Suspense, on Tuned to Yesterday, from July 23, 1961, on CBS. The story, Stranger with My Face, penned by Alan Sloan, who was known for a lot during radio and television's yesteryear. In 1950, he wrote for the NBC show Top Secret and was heralded for having a sensitive touch to his stories for television and radio. And interestingly, according to the New York Times obituary, critics particularly praised his television and radio scripts involving children with physical or mental handicaps, his style certainly translating well for radio and many different broadcasts, including the 1950 series Not for Children, which was sponsored by the Cerebral Palsy Fund Appeal, and showcased Sloan's emotional and moving stories about children with cerebral palsy. You're listening to an hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for The Mysterious Traveler, with a story called The Last Survivor. This mutual episode from October 11th, 1949.
This is The Mysterious Traveler, inviting you to join me on another journey into the realm of the strange and the terrifying. I hope you will enjoy the trip, that it will thrill you a little and chill you a little. So settle back, get a good grip on your nerves, and be comfortable, if you can, as we journey into the unknown in the story I call The Last Survivor. In a small 6 by 10 feet radio compartment, a man sits sprawled in the transmission operator's chair. His hair is unkempt, his face bearded. He stares at the panel board before him with vacant, bloodshot eyes. Now and then, as though in a dream, and as if for the thousandth time, he leans forward and picks up a wireless radio phone.
Calling base, San Augustine. Come in, base, San Augustine. Over. Calling base, San Augustine. Come in, San Augustine. Over.
They don't answer, do they?
No, Connors, I'm afraid not. How do you feel?
I'm all right. Colonel, why don't you try another channel?
I've tried them all. Haven't been able to make contact.
Have you checked the equipment?
Yes, to the best of my ability. As far as I can see, it seems to be in working order.
Maybe if you were to help me to my feet, I could double-check it for you.
No, 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 Connors, lie where you are. Don't try getting up. Take it easy.
But I'm a radio man. I know the equipment.
Later, Connors, later. Is there anything I can get you? Food, water?
No. No, thank you, Colonel. It's strange. Just the two of us out here. Like this.
Yes.
What will you do when you're alone, Colonel?
Alone?
I can't last much longer.
Oh, nonsense, Connors. You're going to be all right. You're going to be all right, do you hear?
Who are you kidding, Colonel? Me? Or yourself? It's a strange way to end up, isn't it?
A strange way to end up? Yes. I remember that day so long ago. So very long ago. I feel as if I were looking back on another age. And perhaps I am. What year was it? 1947? Yes. It was a year like so many the world has known. It was a year of war and peace, of fear and hope, of feast and famine. And I was stationed at the Army Air Base at San Augustine, New Mexico, chief of the experimental rocket section. It was in the spring of 1947, May 8th to be exact, that I was ordered to report at General Farnsworth's office.
Come in.
Colonel Worby reporting, sir.
Oh, come in, Dick. Have a seat.
Thank you, sir.
Orders have just come through for you to report to the chief in Washington.
Washington?
That's right.
Have you any idea what it's about, sir?
Yes, I was speaking to the chief just a few minutes ago. Seems they're interested in those spaceship plans you submitted to them.
My interplanet rocket ship plans?
Yes. The chief and his technical staff seem to think you did an excellent job. It started a certain amount of activity.
But, sir, I clearly stated in my accompanying report that a flight into space is impossible at this time. The fuel just doesn't exist that can power an interplanet spaceship.
It seems that you're wrong, Dick.
Wrong?
Yes. According to Professor Murray, atomic power could make your interplanet ship practical. And if anyone should know, it would be Professor Murray. He helped develop the atomic bomb.
You mean he's interested?
So I understand. The chief's going to ask for an appropriation of $20 million for the development and construction of an atomic-powered spaceship. You and Professor Murray are to work on the project jointly. How soon can you leave?
I'll be ready in an hour, sir.
There'll be a plane at your disposal. Good luck.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I've looked forward for some time now to meeting you, Colonel.
Thank you, Professor Murray. Why did you become interested in my plan, sir?
As you know, I am one of the scientists who helped develop the atomic bomb. It was a terrible responsibility. And we scientists must answer to a great extent for its use. I'm hoping that through a successful spaceship, mankind will turn to peaceful uses of atomic energy.
I understand, sir.
I've studied your plans with minute care. And the ship you've blueprinted is a masterpiece of design.
Thank you, Professor.
Oh, not at all. You deserve praise for your work. Now, as for the fuel problem, I'm convinced atomic energy is the answer.
But, Professor, what about the radiation danger, if it were used?
We would have to design and construct an engine that would be a complete unit in itself, and completely sealed off from the rest of the ship. Now, according to my calculations, very rough calculations at the moment, the ship would have to achieve an acceleration of 4H to reach a velocity of 8 miles a second, at which speed it could attain enough momentum to work.
A little over 2 years later, the completed XIP-1 was wheeled from its hangar at San Augustine, New Mexico. Its towering cylindrical body rose 240 feet into the air, and its silver nose, pointing skyward, gleamed under the strong sun. The field was cleared of all personnel, and from a concrete observation control tower 2 miles away, Professor Murray and I prepared to send it on its first test flight.
Well, Dick, this is it. The culmination of all our years of work. There's the XIP out there ready for flight.
Yes. Well, the next few hours will tell all. Field's been cleared, Professor. We're ready to proceed.
Then take over, Dick. I'll stand by. Keep an eye on the observation radar and control course.
Sound flight warning signal.
Sound flight warning signal.
Switch on control panel.
Switch on control panel.
Switch on tower receiver.
Switch on tower receiver.
Switch on XIP flight radio center.
Switch on XIP flight radio center.
Cut in nuclear jet number one.
Cut in nuclear jet number one.
The ship is hovering, Dick.
Yes. Cut in nuclear jet number two.
Cut in nuclear jet number two.
The XIP. She's taking off.
Instrument reading.
Rate of flight, 500 miles per hour. Altitude, 1,000 feet. Rate of flight, 2,000 miles per hour. Altitude, 90,000 feet. Rate of altitude, 4,000 miles per hour.
Hour after hour, we traced the flight of the XIP through space. When night came, the ship's flaming tail became visible to the naked eye as it traveled further and further into the infinite. At dawn, after the XIP had flown well over 1,000,000 miles, electronic light signals were sent out to reverse the ship's course and direct it back toward Earth. 12 hours later, the XIP landed safely at the San Augustine base. It was that moment that was the beginning of a new age. The age of interplanet travel. A year passed, and the XIP made test flight after test flight, flying greater and greater distances on automatic radio instrument control. And finally, the day came when we were ready. Ready to consider the first human flight into space.
Well, Dick, after weeks of discussion with our leading scientists, our objective has been selected.
What's it to be, Professor?
The planet Mars.
Oh. Oh, why Mars?
Oh, for a number of very excellent reasons. Mars is the closest planet to us. Furthermore, it's the planet that we know the most about, little as that may be.
Mars, that would be a flight of approximately 50 million miles one way.
Yes. How soon do you think the XIP can be prepared for such a flight?
Oh, I should estimate 30 days.
30 days. All right, Jake. We'll set September 15th as flight day.
Ready for flight, sir. The crew are at their station.
Thank you. Is there anything, Professor, you want to say before we take off?
No, Dick. Everyone's been thoroughly briefed.
Well, then the moment's arrived. Stand by for flight orders.
Stand by for flight orders.
Sound warning signal.
Sound warning signal.
Fasten safety belts.
Fasten safety belts.
Switch on flight vision screen.
Switch on flight vision screen.
Establish contact with base.
Establish contact with base.
Cut in nuclear jet number one.
Cut in nuclear jet number one.
Cut in nuclear jet number two.
Cut in nuclear jet number two.
We're off.
Instrument reading.
Flight distance covered, 5,000 feet. Time, 5 seconds. Flight velocity, 600 miles per hour. Flight distance covered, 80,000 feet. Time, 9 seconds. Flight velocity, 2,000 miles per hour.
With each passing second, the XIP gains speed, carrying us ever faster towards the edge of the Earth's gravitational field. All was silent in the command room, except for the voice of the control officer reading the instrument panels. As the 8th minute flight mark approached, we reached the zenith of our speed, the professor blacked out, held from falling only by his safety belt. One by one, the technicians and crew members lost consciousness. And then I, too, found my vision failing, and all became black. When I regained consciousness, I found other members of the crew already recovered and at their stations. The professor was slowly coming, too, as I got to my feet. Instrument reading.
Flight distance covered, 15,000 miles. Time, 27 minutes, 30 seconds. Flight velocity, 26,000 miles per hour.
How do you feel, Professor?
Oh, my heart's acting up a bit, but I can't expect too much from it at my age. Everyone else all right?
Yes, everyone came through fine. Professor, look at the flight vision screen. You can see the Earth, 16,000 miles behind us.
As a scientist, I knew what it would look like from this distance, and yet it's incredible. You can see the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans and the North and South American continents from pole to pole. Half the world.
Yes. It's like looking down on a small globe of the world.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Are we holding to our course, Dick?
Oh, yes, Professor. The automatic instrument controls haven't deviated a hairline. We're dead on course.
Good. If our calculations are correct, in 76 days, we should reach Mars.
The days and weeks passed, and each was one of discovery, of new knowledge, of sights never before seen by human beings. Excitement grew ever increasingly greater as the flight distance to Mars lessened. Crew members would stand for hours before the flight vision screen, scanning the planet we were bound for. At dawn of the 76th day, we approached Mars. The nuclear jet engines were cut. And as Mars drew us towards her orbit, we prepared to land. Stand by to land on Mars.
Attention, crew members. Stand by to land on Mars.
How quiet it is. It seems strange not to hear the engines after 76 days.
Yes. Switch on radox sender.
Switch on radox sender.
Instrument reading. Rate of descent, 1,000 miles per hour. Altitude, 300,000 feet.
The orbit of Mars is exerting a strong pull toward its surface.
Yes. Switch on retarding jet number one.
Switch on retarding jet number one.
Instrument reading.
Rate of descent, 500 miles per hour. Altitude, 100,000 feet.
Once we enter Mars' atmosphere, it'll help cut down our speed.
We should be just about entering it now.
Rate of descent, 200 miles per hour. Altitude, 60,000 feet. Entering atmosphere. Pressure, 2 pounds.
That's much better.
Rate of descent, 100 miles per hour. Altitude, 20,000 feet. Pressure, 5 pounds. Hovering. Altitude, 1,000 feet. 800 feet. 600. 300. 100. Flight completed.
Cut retarding jet number one.
Cut retarding jet number one.
Cut radox sender.
Cut radox sender.
Well, Professor, we've done it. We've reached another planet and begun a new age.
Yes. Let's hope that as a result of this flight, atomic energy will be used for peace and not for war.
Well, shall we have a look at this planet?
Switch on scanning screen.
Switch on scanning screen.
A moment later, a picture formed on the scanning screen, and we saw the landscape of Mars. As far as the eye could see, there was desert. Wide tracts of brown, barren soil broken here and there by ugly, thorny desert plants. Now and then, a gust of wind would come swirling across this desert, all but obscuring the view. There were no visible signs of life out there. Only great vastness. And great loneliness. It's just wasteland. Nothing but wasteland.
It reminds me a great deal of the deserts of Tibet.
Disappointing, isn't it?
Oh, come now. This is only a small part of Mars. Who knows what the countryside may be a few hundred miles from here.
Yes, that's true. The Martian canals, which we've studied through telescopes on Earth, now we'll be able to see them close up.
Yes, it's going to be a great adventure exploring this planet. Well, we'd better proceed with our preliminary test, Dick. Ascertain what the air out there is composed of, what the temperature is, and 101 other things.
I'll assemble our scientists at once, Professor, and have them go to work. We seem to have accumulated over 1,000 pages of scientific notes almost overnight, Professor.
Yes, we've accomplished quite a bit. The air out there is composed of 15% oxygen, 83.7% nitrogen, and traces of other gases.
Is that sufficient oxygen for us to live out there?
Yes, but you'll find yourself constantly gasping for breath. It'll be necessary to carry along pure oxygen and breathe it in now and then.
I see. When may we leave the ship?
I suggest we start this afternoon. I'll draw up a list of the equipment we'll need. What's that?
Our radar alarm. Someone has broken through the radar system. Connors, what zone is this breakthrough from?
Zone 5, sir.
Zone 5. That means 250 miles away. Connors, can you pick up anything?
I can hear something very faintly, sir. Sounds like motors.
Motors?
Well, it looks as if we've learned something else. Not only is Mars inhabited, but it apparently has a highly developed civilization.
Yes.
They're in Zone 4 now, sir. I can pick up the sound of motors quite clearly.
Zone 4. That means they'll reach us in another 3 minutes. Professor, you've seen my orders. In a situation such as this, I'm to take off and return to Earth.
Yes, I know. What a pity to have come so far and have to return now.
I know, but those are my orders. We can't risk the XIP and all the knowledge we've gained.
Yes, you're right.
Zone 3 has been penetrated, sir.
Stand by to take off.
Attention, crew members. Stand by to take off.
Cut off radar system.
Cut off radar system.
Cut in nuclear jet number one.
Cut in nuclear jet number one.
Cut in nuclear jet number two.
Cut in nuclear jet number two.
after week passed uneventfully as we traveled homeward. Already we were discussing the second flight we would make to Mars and the other spaceships that would be built to follow the path of the XIP.
Well, Dick, there's our own planet looming larger with each passing hour.
Yes. Another 48 hours and we'll be home. I imagine our return will create quite a stir.
Yes. I hope it won't delay us too long in preparing for our second flight.
This flight of ours will have a tremendous effect on mankind.
Yes. And I'm hoping for the better. Mankind can't stand an atomic war. It would be the end of us all.
Well, look at the flight vision screen. Certainly, the Earth appears peaceful enough at this moment.
Yes, but a weapon such as atomic energy...
Professor!
What is it?
The flight vision screen. Look. Huge explosions on Earth.
What? Good Lord.
Look. One explosion after another. Great fires mushrooming up. What is it, an earthquake?
No, Dick.
Well, then what?
Those are atomic explosions.
What? Oh, no, no, they couldn't be.
I was at Los Alamos, Bikini. I've seen atomic explosions before.
Connors.
Yes, sir?
Establish radio contact with San Augustine.
Yes, sir. XIP calling base.
It's horrible.
San Augustine.
Horrible.
XIP calling base.
One explosion after another.
Come in, base.
The whole Earth appears to be in flames.
Yes.
Over.
It's the end of the world.
Now, don't talk like that. It can't be. Connors, what's wrong?
I don't know, sir. San Augustine doesn't answer. All I hear are explosions.
Good Lord. Why? Why?
Professor, the Earth seems to be disintegrating. Great fiery pieces are being blown into space.
It is disintegrating. The atomic explosions have started a chain reaction. In a few more seconds, the XIP will feel the impact.
You mean out here?
Yes, even out here.
Sound the alarm! All crew members to stations.
It's too late, Dick. Nothing can save us. It's the end of the world and us. Any moment now, there'll be a gigantic explosion which will reach...
When I regained consciousness, 12 hours later, I was lying in the radio compartment beside Connors, the radio man. My left arm and a number of my ribs were broken, and I had a slight concussion of the brain. I pulled myself to my feet and staggered into the command room. The nuclear engines were silent. The ship a shambles. The professor and 7 other men in the command room had been killed almost instantaneously. I slowly made my way through one compartment after another. Out of a crew of 42, only Connors and myself were alive. I returned to the radio compartment. Hours later, Connors recovered consciousness. Following his instructions, I repaired the scanning screen and turned on a small auxiliary engine which was still in working order. A moment later, a picture formed on the scanning screen.
Is that the Colonel?
Yes, Connors. What's left of it?
There are still huge fires burning.
Yes.
The whole face of the Earth seems changed. I can't recognize any part of it.
Nor can I.
Colonel, what do you think happened?
I don't know. You and I will never know.
Do you suppose anyone could have lived through it?
No, Connors, no. No one could have lived through it.
I didn't think so. What are we going to do, Colonel?
Do? There's nothing we can do. The XIP is disabled. It'll remain here out in space. We have food and water for 6 months, possibly longer.
I wish I had gone with the others.
Oh, no, no, don't talk like that, Connors.
What will you do when you're alone, Colonel?
Alone?
I can't last much longer.
Nonsense, Connors. You're going to be all right.
Who are you kidding, Colonel? Me? Or yourself? It's a strange way to end up, isn't it?
Connors. I'm alone now. Sitting here, staring at the scanning screen. And as I look at that burning, unrecognizable planet once called Earth, the same question keeps running through my mind. What happened? And why? Why did the Earth explode in fire? Was there anything that I, Richard Werby, might have done to prevent that all-consuming holocaust? And I know that as long as I, the last survivor, live, I'll keep asking myself, why did it happen? Why?
The Mysterious Traveler on Tuned to Yesterday from the 11th of October, 1949, from Mutual Radio. And that brings to a close this hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden years. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks for listening.